If God loves humans, why does he allow pain, misery, and death? BC had lived a secular life, but at his deathbed, he was asking existential questions to a Catholic priest beside him, his lungs wheezing, on occasion a mild crackling noise as his time was almost up. He had been diagnosed with lung cancer, and the last few months have been an excruciating battle. Surrounding him were probably his sons, daughters, his wife, and a few close Samsung employees who are called the Samsung Man. An almost superhero-like name, the Samsung Man, refers to the never-say-die attitude of the employees who dedicate their life to building the empire. In return, they are given excellent benefits, pay, and social recognition. It was assumed that the Samsung Men were treated the best of any employee in South Korea. As such, they were the best in South Korea. And today, on the 18th of November 1987, the leader of the Samsung Man was at his final stretch. Doctors had given their estimates. He would not live past today. As BC Lee stared into the abyss, he might have wondered about the life he lived. The incredible empire that started as a vegetable and dried fish shop in Daegu City had grown into a conglomerate with tendrils in food, chemicals, technology, and media. For all of Samsung Group's glory, he wondered how many people knew the dirt that was underneath. The deal that he made with the then President Park had forced his company to become intertwined with politics. It made them bow often to their political agenda, sending money and resources to the state. But in return, it elevated them to be above the law. It was a necessary deal that must continue after his death. For as long as they maintain a deep relationship with those in the cabinet, Samsung would be unstoppable. It's about time, the doctor whispered to his family. BC's mind was starting to run wild as he grew more tired.
Everything I did was for the betterment of Koreans and to keep Samsung within the family. That should resolve my sins, right?
He might have thought, as his heart began to relax. At 5.05 p.m., B.C. Lee, South Korea's richest man and founder of Samsung Group, could finally rest. But the Samsung Man surrounding him could not. They had little time and immediately set off, bringing Lee Kun-hee, B.C.'s third son, with them. The Samsung Man had helped B.C. orchestrate a complicated cross-shareholding deal, devaluing and reorganizing the company's different subsidiaries to ensure that enough stock had been acquired by Kun-hee. And now, all that's left is to vote. 25 minutes later, the presidents of Samsung's 37 affiliates convened at the Samsung Group headquarters.
I'll be quick. Who's in favor of Kun-hee to lead?
A Samsung man said. As if it was a competition, the hands raised almost instantly.
That settles it, then.
Kun-hee noticed the eyes of all 37 leaders on him.
So, Chairman Lee, what would you have us do?
From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 3 of a 5-part series, The Power of the Sun. The great first chairman, B.C. Lee's death, was shocking. He had built the largest chaebol in South Korea that was accredited to its economic growth. However, Samsung's flirtatious relationship with politicians would mire the company's history books and provide precedents for his descendants to do the same. But to his third son, Lee Kun-hee, learning to politic was the last of his concerns, for at age 45, he had become the new chairman of Samsung Electronics, a momentous occasion that fractured their family. Historically, BC's second son was expected to lead. However, due to a foolish attempt at embezzling money, he had jeopardized the family standing with President Park, a vicious leader who demanded retribution from Samsung. Under BC's eyes, his second son was no longer fit to lead, and neither was his first son, who had displayed erratic behavior during his temporary stint as chairman. By elimination, BC announced that Kun-hee, the third son, would be next in line, which sparked a family feud that splintered the Samsung Corporation into five separate entities. The crown jewel of that is Samsung Electronics, which BC would retain for Kun-hee. The question was if he could rise to the occasion and prove himself worthy of the Samsung man loyalty. To increase his aptitude and chance for success, his father BC had instructed Kun-hee to join Samsung in 1966, when he was age 24, to begin his training. And at first it seemed like he could never impress the Samsung man. For much of his first 10 years, there weren't any significant contributions tied specifically to Kun-hee. It could be his quiet and reserved nature that held him back, or simply his lack of understanding of the massive empire. However, as Samsung started pivoting deeper into electronics, an opportunity would emerge that allowed BC to make a name for himself. It's year 1982, 5 years before BC's death. Both BC and Kun-hee were on a plane back to South Korea. Over the years of 1969 to early 1970s, Samsung had formed partnerships with Sanyo, NEC Corporation, and Sumimoto Corporation to train about 137 Samsung employees. Upon returning, they would spread across the division and continue to work closely with Sanyo to release their first black and white TV in 1970. By the end of that year, the division recorded $250,000 in sales, and by 1978, had sold around 2 million black and white TVs. Samsung also expanded into two new verticals, chemical manufacturing, then shipbuilding. With all the progress so far, you would think that the owners of Samsung would be celebrating on that plane. But instead, BC seemed to be in a rut, while his son Kun-hee was preparing to shake his father out of it. Over the past few days, they had traveled to Boston, mainly because BC had received an honorary doctorate at Boston University. However, they realized that the epicenter of semiconductor technology happened to be in America. So they made a quick detour to view the factories of IBM, GE, and HP. Their technology was astounding, far more advanced than what they had back in South Korea, to the point that Samsung wasn't really producing the same component at all. While both were semiconductor devices, Samsung's was a generation behind and more suited for basic calculators, in an era where the first personalized computers were released.
"We are too late, son,"
BC said despondent as he left the factories.
"Let's return home."
To BC, the Americans' progress had cast doubt if Samsung could ever catch up in the semiconductor business. But Kun-hee thought differently. And now over 9,000 meters or 30,000 feet in the air, Kun-hee had to convince his father to stay in the semiconductor business. There's a couple of ways that he could play this. The first angle would be the time and effort angle. Well, time, effort, and a little bit of luck. By chance, a California entrepreneur had called their Samsung CEO, JK, to share about his ailing semiconductor joint venture. Sensing an opportunity, the Samsung chairman gave approval to buy up his share of the venture. Kun-hee, who had overseen the project and observed the rising reliance on semiconductors, realized that this could be huge. So he partially financed the remaining part of the deal to acquire the entire company. You might argue that Kunhee got a little too personal in this venture, but to him, it didn't change the story. Samsung had invested significant time and effort. Surely, they wouldn't want it to go to waste. The second part that Kunhee could play is the national security angle. When President Park pushed South Korea to adopt and produce technology, they had to rely on American loans to finance their operation. These loans were in danger of defaulting should the semiconductor industry fail. But besides money, it's also important that Samsung maintains a relationship of servitude with the government in order to continue the privileges that it always had. This angle was a little more shaky, for the Park administration had changed after his assassination in 1979. So Kunhee decided to go with the third story.
Father, I want to talk to you about the semiconductor business.
Son, I think this trip is sobering. Don't you think we're too late?
Yeah, about that, I think it doesn't matter. All that matters is if staying within semiconductors would help us.
What do you mean?
Well, look at Hyundai. They have just begun manufacturing semiconductors. Do we want to lose them?
Kunhee could see the competitive fire in his father light up.
Of course not.
In the end, Samsung decided to stay in semiconductors defensively against Hyundai, a move that reflected BC's ultra-competitive nature. But given the timing, some would argue it was his first signal that he would truly be passing Samsung over to Kunhee. Shortly after he was diagnosed with lung cancer and would pass before the first advanced semiconductors rolled off the assembly line, filled with respect, gratitude, and a sense of uncertainty, the Samsung man and his son took the very first semiconductor and laid it onto BC's grave.
Thank you, Father. You were right. Growing this business had been tough. But I promise you that I'll do everything I can to grow it. Keep looking out for me, Father.
In the years that followed, Kunhee invested hard in R&D and innovation, and by the 2000s, Samsung Semiconductor's division would reach an inflection point, producing semiconductors that were far superior than its Japanese and American rivals. Eventually, the division would become Samsung's electronics' most profitable business, contributing to an unbelievable 50% of its operating profit. Kunhee's decision to stay in semiconductors and subsequently to invest in innovation made the lucky scion seem more capable than lucky. Over time, this, amongst other incidents, began to shape his thinking that quality trumps quantity. And for a long time, it would remain an ideology in his mind until a wave of incidents occurred. The first was the rise of Japanese companies, most notably Sony, which bought Columbia Pictures in 1989 for $3.4 billion. But more importantly, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1991.
In the thousands, they are here in the tens of thousands. Occasionally they shout, "Die Mauer muss weg, the wall must go."
To Kunhee, he felt that it ended the Cold War, but opened up a new type of economic warfare, globalization. Without a heavy-handed protectionist leader like the assassinated President Park, would Korean companies survive the onslaught from the West and Japan? These questions and events had Kunhee mulling during the day and anxious at night. And by the summer of 1992, he had reportedly lost 10 kgs or 20 pounds of weight. You might think him funny or even paranoid, but having grown up as the son of the richest man in Korea, and observing his siblings betray one another, Kunhee's paranoia is probably what kept him safe so far. His fear would continue building up, and by 1993, it would finally translate into the history of Samsung in what employees would call the Frankfurt Declaration. It was June 7, 1993, 5 years after the death of Samsung's founder. Samsung had begun diverting funds from the rest of its business units into Samsung Electronics, largely to develop their own suite of technology IP. They had also expanded to Asia, Europe, and the Americas, which was how Samsung products ended up in the hands of technophiles who laughed at Samsung, or in their words, Samsuck. Kun-hee had gathered 200 of Samsung's executives from Seoul into Frankfurt for an impromptu management meeting. Few knew what this meeting was about. Some would enter smiling, having never been to Germany before. One by one, everyone gathered in the luxurious Kempinski Hotel, Frankfurt, Gravenbruck, possibly enjoying the small bites as they found their seats. Near the front of the stage was Tamio Fukuda, who, unlike everyone else, had no appetite for anything. He had been hired as the design advisor to Kun-hee, and he suspected that his report had triggered this meeting. For the past 3 years, he had been covertly gathering information, setting up surveillance for Kun-hee to understand why Samsung products were being made fun of. On the surface, management would paint a rosy picture. But was that really the case? 3 days ago, Fukuda had finalized his report and presented it to Kun-hee.
Chairman Lee, what I'm going to show you is simply as it is, Fukuda muttered.
On the TV screen was a small team that was closing the doors of washing machines. Majority couldn't seem to close it properly. They then took out a utility knife and started shaving the plastic off the door before shutting it again. This would occur over and over until they could finally close the door.
Fukuda-san, what's this that I'm seeing here?
Kun-hee's face was turning red.
Are our washing machine doors not able to close? Chairman Lee, you're right. Our assembly molds are so inaccurate that none of the washing machines can close, so they've been shaving off the excess plastic manually. Is no one fixing the assembly molds itself? No.
Chairman Lee sat down, hands possibly shaking.
How many more problems are there? It's in the majority of our products.
Fukuda could tell something inside Chairman Lee had snapped as he proceeded into a room. Quietly waiting outside, Fukuda could hear his screams at the management on washing machine production, which lasted for an hour.
I thought we talked about maintaining a higher quality. From now on, I will be in charge.
Back in Kempinski, Fukuda spotted the washing machine management team. Like him, they were seated there, weary. Both knew that it was going to be a fiery lecture.
Settle down,
Chairman Lee took the stage.
A new crisis is upon us. A more intense economic war had begun, and we are standing on the edge of a cliff facing a life or death situation.
Everyone was shocked, except Fukuda. He proceeded to expand on the punishing reality that South Korean firms were no longer their benchmark as Japanese and American rivals could come in. Then he declared that moving forward today, they would go from quantity-driven manufacturing to quality-driven manufacturing. By then, it was lunchtime, and the hotel staff brought in sandwiches to the executives as President Lee continued on.
Change everything except your wife and children, because starting today, we are in perpetual crisis.
He would continue this for the next 2 days, on occasion throwing in expletives at people for at least 8 hours a day. Convinced that he had sent the message across, Chairman Lee then arranged lunch with his team.
What did you think about the message so far? Chairman Lee asked. The executives, a little nervous, were nodding, as a sign that things were going well. Except one man who spoke. Chairman Lee, thanks for the learning. I think I realized today that quality is also important. What do you mean, also?
Chairman Lee could read the subtext.
I mean, quality and quantity are just two sides of the same coin.
Before the man could finish, a spoon smashed across the room, and Chairman Lee stood up.
I see.
Over the next 3 months, he decided that since not all executives were in agreement, he would pass the message himself and traveled across the world to deliver the speech. To ensure his message was not lost, he spoke to each team level, eventually spending 350 hours lecturing and resulting in a body of text dubbed the New Management Initiative. His push from quantity to quality was pivotal, as Samsung sought to become a world superpower in technology. Having one unified voice was also severely overdue, as Samsung had begun expanding haphazardly through a mixture of joint ventures, partnerships, and distributors. This would spill over to marketing, and by the turn of the century, Samsung had 55 advertising agencies under contract, each sending their own messaging of what Samsung is. Unification beyond just company culture was needed to beat their competitors, particularly Sony and a rising Apple, which released their iPod in 2001. It was time for the Samsung man to leave the lecture halls into the global stage and wage a cosmic war to become the largest TV and smartphone manufacturer in the world.
Egon here played a pivotal role in helping South Korea rise as a global leader from a modest beginning under Lee's leadership and is now a world-leading multi-billion dollar player in the global smartphone and semiconductor industries.
Lee inherited the Samsung crown after the passing of his father, Lee Byung-chul, who founded the company.
From 1UP Media, this is Empires. Episode 3 of a 5-part series, The Power of the Sun. Next, in Empires, we'll learn the three largest wars that Samsung waged between Sony, Apple, and Google that birthed the Galaxy series. Follow us so you won't miss out on episode 4 of our 5-part series, A Cosmic War with Sony. Empires is a 1UP Media original, produced and edited by Gwang Jin, audio experience by Ethan Sam, and narrated by Peter Ng. A quick word on our reenactments and dramatizations. While we can't know exactly what they say, think, or feel at the moment, it is all based on research. Thank you for listening.